Frost wasn't so sure. People were good at keeping secrets from those close to them, whether it was about affairs, alcohol, or addictions. There was a similar incident a couple months ago, Frost told Tejada. A woman had a psychotic episode at a wedding reception. She shot herself. Like Brynn, the behavior seemed to come out of nowhere. I've been trying to find some overlap in their lives to see if they had a connection that might explain what happened to both of them. So far, I've come up empty. Tejada nodded. I remember that incident from the news. Brynn and I talked about it. What did she say? Just that it was scary and bizarre? We both assumed what you did, that it must be drugs. And did she mention anything that might suggest a connection between the two of them? I'm sorry, no. The thing is, Mr. Tejada, this behavior usually has an explanation, but friends and family often miss the clues. Then they look back and remember little things that seem important in the wake of what happened. Was there anything like that with Brynn? Tejada was silent for a long time. He crossed his arms and stared at his shoes. Lawyers didn't give flip answers. Frost knew that because he had a law degree himself. He'd also worked with a lot of lawyers in his years with the police, and if there was one thing he liked about them, among the many things he didn't, it was that they never answered a question without thinking about it. Finally, Tejada said one word, but it was something that Frost didn't expect. Cats, he said. Frost cocked his head. What? Do you like cats, Inspector? I do, in fact, Frost replied. So do I. I have 4 cats. Okay, Frost said, not understanding. Brynn was scared to death of cats, Tejada went on. When I first met her, she couldn't spend 5 minutes in my condo. She hated cats, couldn't stand being around them. People who don't grow up around cats often don't understand them, but this was a deeper phobia with Brynn. When I asked her about it, she told me that she'd had a bad experience with a feral cat as a teenager. She was bitten multiple times. She had to undergo a painful round of rabies shots. I don't understand the connection, Frost said. You wanted clues, Inspector. You wanted something unusual. This is the only unusual thing I can think of. That Brynn was scared of cats. Tejada shook his head. No, here's the strange thing. The two of us typically met at restaurants, not at my place because of my cats. If we wanted to be together overnight, I'd get us a hotel room. And then last month, she showed up at my place on a Saturday afternoon. I went to open some wine for us, and when I came back, I found her sprawled on the living room floor playing with my cats and letting them walk all over her. Since that time, she hasn't had any issues with my cats at all. Did you ask her about it? Of course. She said she didn't want my cats to be a problem between us, so she'd been seeing a psychiatrist to help with her fears. Apparently it worked, Frost said. Yes, I guess it did. I was glad she felt strongly enough about our relationship to do something like that. But there was one peculiar thing. Last week I made some kind of joking reference to the time when the feral cat had bitten her. She seemed genuinely puzzled. She said nothing like that had ever happened to her. I began rattling off the details of the story, but she got upset and said I was wrong, and told me to drop it. Did you? Tejada frowned. Sure I did. I was glad she'd become a cat lover. But I wasn't wrong, Inspector. The cat attack really happened to her. At first I assumed she didn't want to think about it anymore, but it was more than that. It was as if the whole episode had been completely erased from her memory. 6. Frankie kept one sympathy card on her desk from the death of her father. She'd filed away all of the others weeks ago. It wasn't even a card from a close friend, because Frankie didn't have many people that she considered friends. The woman who sent it was a colleague from a nonprofit board. Frankie kept the card because it was a reminder of how wrong people could be. Inside, the woman had written, "My father was the greatest hero in my life. I know what you're going through." If only that were true. People assumed that when you lost a parent, you felt nothing but pure grief. They didn't account for complex relationships. And the relationship between Marvin Stein and his daughters was nothing if not complex. She kept a photo of her father on her desk. When she picked it up, she could hear his cold voice in her head, passionless and demanding. The photo showed him in his physics lab at UC Berkeley, in his white lab coat, Like her, he was tall and thin. He had wiry gray hair and a neat mustache. He didn't smile, and his eyes were impatient. Her father never liked to bother with emotional frills like photographs. When Frankie took the picture with her phone, he'd said, "Get on with it, get on with it." Her mother had died of cancer when Frankie was 5, just a year after her sister Pam was born. Since then, their family had been just the 3 of them. Marvin Stein, physicist, was not meant to be a single father. He dealt with numbers, theories, and formulas, not children, and definitely not girls. It was hard enough when they were young, but it got worse during high school and college. Their father demanded perfection. Anything but straight A's and top test scores was a failure. Because he was a success himself, he pushed his daughters to do more and achieve more. Nothing was ever good enough. Frankie responded by setting crazy expectations for herself that might win his praise. Pam responded by defying him altogether and throwing her failures in his face. And now he was gone. More than 3 months later, he still haunted her. "Are you thinking about Marvin again?" Jason asked. Her husband stood in the doorway of her office. He was dressed in running clothes, and his hands were on his hips. Sweat glowed on his narrow face. "Yes, I keep thinking about that last camping trip," she said, toying with the photograph of her father with her fingertips. "Dwelling on it won't change what happened," Jason told her. "Oh, I know." Jason sat in the comfortable chair in front of her desk. He worked in the headquarters of a large pharmaceutical company, a few blocks away on Post Street, but he often went running through the city midway through the afternoon and showed up at her office while she was on a break between appointments. Her own office was located on the top floor of a 10-story building on the east side of Union Square, looking out on the palm trees of the park. "It's also not going to change what a son of a bitch Marvin was," Jason added. Frankie's lips bent into a sad smile. "I know that, too." "So how do you feel?" he asked in a clinical way. They were both scientists. Sometimes it was hard to remember they were husband and wife, too. She expected him to take out a yellow pad and start taking notes while they talked. "I feel off," she said. "Can I be more specific?" "Not really. Something's not right with me, Jason, but I don't know what it is. I think it's called grief." He was right, but that didn't make her feel better. Another husband might have come out of his chair and hugged her, but that wasn't Jason, and that wasn't the kind of relationship they had. They weren't touchy-feely. She'd met him 7 years ago at a conference in Barcelona. He was British. They were both in their early 30s. She'd noticed when she met him that he was handsome, although their interactions were purely professional in the beginning. He had an athletic build and close-cropped black hair. His dark eyes missed nothing, and he had an expressive mouth that could shift from humor to disdain with the twitch of his lips. His face was full of sharp angles, and so was his personality. She liked that. She hated men who tried to woo her. They'd stayed in touch after the conference because they both specialized in memory. He worked on the neurological side, focused on brain chemistry. She worked on the therapeutic side. 9 months later, he took a research position with a pharmaceutical company in San Francisco, and their meetings evolved slowly from professional to personal. A year after that, they married, to the amusement of her sister Pam, who'd assumed that Frankie would never leave her clinical office long enough to meet a man. She'd found a husband who was a carbon copy of herself, smart, demanding, unemotional. Or maybe, she occasionally whispered to herself, she'd done what so many other women did and married her father. "After he died, you told me you felt some closure with him," Jason reminded her. "I know. I still do. Do you remember why?" Frankie did. The camping trip snapped like a photograph into her mind. It was something that she, Pam, and their father had done annually since they were children. On New Year's Eve, they would travel to a state park around Northern California and spend 2 nights there. They'd stayed as close as Angel Island in the bay and traveled as far afield as Redwood National Park north of Eureka. It was a family tradition, but their father had a way of turning the outings into intellectual exercises. He selected a discussion theme. He assigned reading and quizzed them like a professor. The topics had ranged over the years from politics to science to economics. Minimum wage policy, extraplanetary life, addiction, Alaskan glaciers. This year's topic had been a strange departure. It was risk, which turned out to be a tragically ironic subject in the wake of what happened to him. "He was different with me that last evening," Frankie said. "Maybe it's because it was just the two of us this year. He relaxed. We talked about Mom. Before we went to sleep, he told me he was proud of me. I've been waiting my whole life to hear something like that from him." "So you got what you wanted," Jason said. Frankie stared out her office window. She could see the crowds in Union Square 10 stories below her. "Yes, he could have told me he loved me, and it wouldn't have meant as much as him being proud of me." He heard her hesitation. "So what's wrong?" "I don't know. I don't know." "It hasn't even been 4 months, Frankie. That's not long enough when you lose a parent. Don't rush yourself." "You're right." Frankie shook her head and added, "Pam missed out." "If she'd been there, it wouldn't have been the same," Jason reminded her. "Marvin treated her differently." "I know." "Maybe you got the closure you needed because it was just the two of you," he pointed out. "I've thought about that, but it makes me feel guilty." "You had no way of knowing what was going to happen?" "No." On New Year's Day, her father had awakened early, at sunrise, which was typical. He made coffee and took a hike along the bluff trails of Point Reyes. He told Frankie to stay behind, which was a surprise. Normally he made her and Pam get up and join him on his early walks. It didn't matter how late they'd been up the night before. He hiked north of Arch Rock, where the cliffs dropped sharply to the rocks and beach. It had rained overnight. The earth of the headlands was soft and yielding. Hours later, when he still hadn't returned, Frankie alerted the rangers. They found Marvin Stein's body at the base of the cliff. Jason checked his watch. "I have to get back to work. Are you and Pam going to Zingari tonight?" "Probably. Do you want us to wait for you for dinner?" "No, I might be late." "Okay." Her husband got up, and his sharp eyes examined her face. "Are you still feeling off?" "Yes. I don't know exactly what it is." She stared out the window again, and without looking at Jason, she said, "Do you think that he..." Jason waited, but Frankie didn't go on. He answered her question without her asking it, because she couldn't form the words. "No, I don't think that Marvin killed himself," Jason said. "He's not the kind of man who would take his own life. It was an accident. The cliffs are dangerous. He fell." 7. Frost heard Lucy Hagen's footsteps inside as she hurried to answer the door at the apartment she shared with Bryn Lansing. "Oh, hi, Frost," she said, her face flushing happily when she saw him. Then she corrected herself. "Sorry, Inspector." He returned the greeting with his own friendly, crooked smile. "Frost is fine. Come on in." He crossed the threshold past Lucy and eyed the apartment. There wasn't much to see. It was a studio in an old building on Haight near Octavia. A bay window overlooked the street. 3 steps led up to the bathroom, where he could see a toilet and clawfoot tub. The kitchen could have been slipped into the back of his Suburban. He noticed 2 twin beds, one made, one unmade. Fashion posters were thumbtacked to the walls. The apartment was overstuffed with furniture and clothes. "It's not exactly Seacliff, is it?" Lucy said. "Although it feels that way when I pay the rent." "It's an expensive city." "Yeah, no kidding. I don't know where people get the money. We get some of the super-rich types shopping in the jewelry department at Macy's sometimes. That must be the life, huh?" "They can have it," Frost said. "I've seen what money does to people. It's not pretty." "Oh, I don't know. I wouldn't mind giving it a try. Cops do okay, though, huh?"
"The union takes care of us."
"That must be nice. Nobody's signing up to take care of me. Not that you guys don't earn it. You do." Lucy shook her head. "Sorry. I'm babbling like an idiot. I don't know what I'm saying."
"Don't worry about it.
How long have you lived here?" 2 years. I need a new roommate now, or I'll have to move. I called my parents to tell them what happened, and they think I should get out of the city. They don't think it's safe here. I don't know, maybe they're right, but I'd miss the funk if I left San Fran. Know what I mean?
I do.
How about you? Have you been here long?
All my life.
Where do you live? Frost hesitated. Normally, he didn't talk about personal things. He didn't share secrets easily. Even so, Lucy was easy to talk to, in her sweet, awkward way. She was an ordinary girl with an ordinary life, which was something that Frost liked. The city's beating heart was all the people who got up and went to work and ate lunch and grabbed takeout for dinner and watched the Giants on TV and went to bed. People like Lucy. People like Katie. He also knew that she'd made an effort for him. She was made up, her hair neat, her lipstick bright. She wore going-out clothes, not stay-at-home clothes. That was no accident. She wanted to make an impression.
"My situation is a little odd," he told her. "I live in a house on Russian Hill."
"Wow," Lucy remarked. "Nice."
"It's not mine. The house belongs to Shaq." Her head cocked.
"Wait, isn't Shaq
my cat?"
"You rent from your cat?" she asked.
"Yeah, he's a pretty good landlord."
Lucy folded her arms across her chest. She wore a white sweater. Her brown curls brushed the collar. Her capris showed off the thin taper of her legs.
"You're teasing me."
"Nope."
"Are you going to tell me the story? Because now I'm intrigued."
Frost grinned and shoved his hands in his pockets.
"Yeah, okay. About a year ago, I was called in on a home invasion case. Rich old widow, beautiful house on Russian Hill. She'd been shot dead in her bedroom. The uniforms who responded had a problem because the woman's cat was sitting on her chest, and he wouldn't let anyone near the body. Hissed and batted at them with his claws if they came close. He was protecting her. I grew up with cats, so I figured I'd give it a try. So I just talked to him."
"You talked to the cat?"
"Yeah. I told him I was sorry that the woman was gone, that it was brave of him to want to protect her, but there was nothing he could do anymore. Eventually, he got off her body and walked over to me. He climbed up my leg, curled up on my shoulder, and wouldn't leave. Right then and there, he adopted me."
Lucy blinked back tears. Cat stories did that to women.
"The other cops wanted to take him to animal control, but I said I'd look after him while we did the investigation. Eventually, I talked to the trustee of the woman's estate and asked if there was some family member who wanted to take Shaq. He said there was no family. I said, well, would it be okay if I kept the cat? The trustee got very suspicious and asked if I knew anything about the woman's estate, which was weird. I said no, all I wanted was to adopt the cat. After an hour in which I felt like he was the cop doing an interrogation, I found out that the estate instructions left the house in a bank trust as long as Shaq was alive, and whoever took care of him could live there for $1 a month. The old woman wanted to make sure that somebody had a hell of an incentive to look after her cat. The funny thing is, I was willing to take him for free."
"That's quite the story."
"Yeah. So here I am, the cop who rents a house from his cat."
"Is all of that true? Or have you figured out that a man with a cat is sort of a chick magnet for girls?"
"Honestly, I have found that out, but the story's true. I did have to change his name, though."
"Why?"
"Well, the old woman called him Senor Bubbles. That didn't seem manly enough for either one of us."
Lucy smothered a laugh.
"No."
She bit her lip and played with her hair in a flirty way, but she wasn't really good at flirting. He knew she was attracted to him. He liked her, too, but for different reasons. There was something real about her, and he met a lot of people in San Francisco who weren't real at all. It didn't matter what she said. He just liked listening to her talk.
"What about you?" he asked. "What's the Lucy Hagen story?"
She blushed and looked away. "Oh, that's a boring story."
"I doubt it. Everybody's got a story. Did you grow up in the city?"
"No, out in Modesto. I went to SF State and wanted to stick around after college. Nobody was hiring business majors, so I applied at Macy's. I had dreams of being Jennifer Aniston on Friends, you know, work my way up into the fashion business. But that's not going to happen. So, I don't know. I've thought about going back to get a nursing degree, but I'm already hip-deep in debt. This economy sucks if you don't have a cat who comes with a nice house."
Frost smiled. "You don't want to follow Brin's example, hook up with a rich lawyer?" Lucy rolled her eyes. He guessed that there had been a certain amount of jealousy between Lucy and Bryn.
Yeah, she always had her eyes on the prize when it came to men. The richer, the better.
I don't blame her for it. She and Gabe look good together. I'm sure they would have gotten married and had kids and had a nice house in the hills. Me, I want to figure out who I am before I get involved with somebody.
That's not a bad plan.
Yeah, well, I'm not making much progress on either one. Frost walked over to Bryn's bed. There was an elegant perfume in the sheets. Everything was neatly folded and creased. The nightstand was dusted. The books on the table, all romance novels, were arranged in a perfect stack. Bryn was a precise person, and he thought Lucy was right that Bryn would have fit in well as a Sausalito wife. He asked Lucy, "When did Bryn last sleep here?"
3 nights ago, I guess. I told you she was spending a lot of time at Gabe's. It was nice having the place to myself, actually.
Frost frowned. Something didn't add up.
Gabe said he hadn't seen Bryn in several days.
What?
He said she stayed with him 4 nights ago, then she was off the grid for a couple days. She didn't respond to his calls or texts until yesterday.
Did you see her during that time?
Lucy looked unnerved.
No, she wasn't here.
Was she at work?
I don't know. She's on a different floor. We usually don't see each other. We spend enough time together stuffed into this place, so we don't go out of our way to hang out during the days.
Is there anyone else she might stay with?
Not that I can think of, Lucy said. Her parents, maybe?
Frost shook his head. They said they hadn't seen Bryn in a month.
Well, I don't know. I'm used to her not coming home, but I just assumed she was at Gabe's.
When did you meet with her yesterday?
Frost asked. After work. She was already home when I got back.
Did she say anything about where she'd been?
No. How was her mood? Fine, happy, whistling. I told you, Bryn was always up. We dressed for the party, and then we headed out. She was completely normal, except for...
Except for what? Frost asked.
He thought about Bryn whistling, and he started to whistle too, until he consciously made himself stop.
Lucy sat down in one of the chairs next to the matchbox kitchen table.
Well, I made some comment about thank God tomorrow's Friday. She gave me the blankest look I've ever seen. She took out her phone like she was checking the date, and then she just shrugged it off.
Did she say what was wrong?
No, she just said, brain fart. That was it. We left for the party.
Frost studied Bryn's half of the studio again. Did Bryn own a laptop?
Sure, she kept it under the bed.
Frost got down on hands and knees and peered under Bryn's twin bed. He slid out a Toshiba laptop and booted it up. When the screen turned on, it asked him for a password.
It's secured. Do you happen to know her password?
Lucy nodded. It's B.L. Agogo. Frost keyed it in as Lucy spelled it out for him. When the home screen loaded, he opened up the calendar application. The only appointment listed for the week other than last night's party was a dentist appointment for the previous day at 9 in the morning. The calendar listed the dentist's name and number, and he slid out his cell phone and dialed the office. He explained who he was to the receptionist and asked his question. Then he hung up. Bryn was scheduled for tooth whitening on Thursday morning, Frost said. She never showed up.
Weird. Bryn was fussy about her teeth.
I'd like to know where she was that day, Frost said.
I'm sorry, but I have no idea. She didn't say anything.
Frost didn't know if Bryn's missing time was connected to what happened to her, but he didn't like the fact that she was off the grid so soon before her unexplained breakdown, and that she was acting as if she didn't even know what day it was.
Was Bryn seeing a shrink?
He asked Lucy. Gabe said she went to see someone about her fear of cats.
Yeah, that's right. Bryn was really high on her. She said I should see her for my bridge thing.
When was this?
A few weeks ago. The shrink was pretty expensive. Her parents gave her a couple grand for the treatment. That's how much Gabe meant to her. She didn't want the cat thing to get in the way of their relationship.
Gabe thought the treatment had a strange effect on her memory.
Lucy nodded. That's right. Bryn said the goal was to make you forget whatever was causing your problem. Take away the memory, take away the fear. I guess it worked. Suddenly, Bryn loved cats.
What was the shrink's name? He asked. Do you remember?
Sure, because it was a little creepy. Francesca Stein. You know, Frankie Stein? Frankenstein? We joked about it. I have one of her cards. Do you want it?
I do.
Lucy went over to her side of the apartment and rummaged through her nightstand drawers. She came back and handed him a business card. Her office is right near Macy's, so it was pretty convenient for Bryn. Thank you, Lucy. Frost headed for the door, and Lucy hesitated, as if there was more she wanted to say. He thought she wanted to ask him out, but he knew she wouldn't. It was too easy to follow the path you were on, rather than looking for cross trails that might take you somewhere scary. He was like that, too.
Well, say hi to Shaq for me, Lucy said lamely.
I will.
Hey, did you ever catch the guy that killed the old woman? You know, Shaq's original owner?
Yeah, that was easy, Frost told her with a grin. He showed up at a hospital about 2 hours after the murder, bleeding profusely. He had cat scratches all over his body.
8. Frankie waited for her sister at Zingari, which was their traditional meeting spot twice a week. She had a glass of Russian River Pinot Noir in front of her, along with an order of kotze. That was her dinner. The jazz bar was loud, with the nighttime piano and saxophone duo rising in a mellow beat over the voices of the crowd. A candle flickered on her table. She leaned back into the cushioned bench and watched the reflections of faces in the mirrored wall. Pam was late, as usual. But it didn't matter. She sipped wine and lost herself in the noise. The garlic mussels were perfect. She checked emails on her phone. Most of the messages were business-related, which she could answer in a sentence or two. Follow-up on articles she'd published in scientific journals, queries from colleagues, conference invitations from around the world. She'd spoken on memory reconsolidation on nearly every continent over the past decade. In her field, she was widely known, but her fame had also brought controversy. Many of her peers disagreed bitterly with the ethics of her treatments, and they waged an academic war to discredit her. Frankie didn't care. What mattered for her was the outcomes for her patients. Fame as a therapist had other strange side effects, too. Every night, when she scrolled through her email, she found messages from ordinary people. Some were harmless, some were desperate, others were hate mail she'd learned to ignore. She clicked on one as she drank her wine. You are playing God. You are going to hell, and I am praying for your salvation. She deleted the message, along with several others in a similar vein. She kept the emails from people who had read her book and wanted to share stories of how their own painful memories had taken over their lives. Many wanted help, and she could reply to those from her office in the morning. There was one message left that she hadn't opened. The email had no subject line. When she checked the date stamp, she saw that it had come into her inbox only 5 minutes earlier. Frankie opened the message, which contained one line. Remember me? There was nothing else. No signature. No attachment. She checked the return address of the sender and saw thenightbird@gmx.com. Frankie's brow furrowed with puzzlement. Something about the message unnerved her more than the others. She wasn't sure what it was. She'd received much worse from strangers. This was nothing, and yet she realized what was bothering her. When she checked her name, she saw that the message had come to her personal email account, not the business email address from her website. Her personal address was private. She gave it out only to family and friends, and to a very small number of patients whom she considered at risk of suicide. Even when she muted her phone at night, that email address was programmed to ring through and alert her to a new message. Fan mail? Frankie looked up. Her favorite waiter, Virgil, hovered over her table with a bottle of wine. He had a luxuriant wave of shock white hair that even women envied. His dark eyes were wicked, and his lips curled into a permanent smirk. He was tall and wore a tight black shirt and black pants. She put down her phone. The battery was low, so she removed a portable charger from her purse and connected it. Someone's praying for my soul again.
Well, you and me need all the help we can get, Virgil replied. I figure I'm on the smite list if God gets bored. I keep looking up at the sky for a lightning bolt.
This is California, Virgil. When the smite comes, it'll be an earthquake.
Virgil spread his long arms wide. Did you feel that? Was that a tremor? Frankie laughed. Virgil could always make her laugh.
More fruit of the vine?
He asked her.
Definitely.
Virgil refilled her glass. His pours were generous. She was a regular, and she tipped well. The other servers at the restaurant knew that Virgil took the table whenever Frankie, Pam, and Jason came in. Frankie liked him. He was a San Francisco party child, always short of cash and crashing with gay friends. He was technically homeless, but nothing vanquished his sense of humor, which Frankie admired. He was proof that you could still live off the kindness of strangers.
"Where's your sister tonight?" he asked.
Frankie was about to answer when a voice called from behind him.
"I'm here! I'm here!"
Pam threaded her way toward the table through the Friday crowd. She had a way of parting the seas as she walked. A shopping bag from Nordstrom Rack dangled from one finger. With a toss of her long bottle blonde hair, she slid into the chair opposite Frankie and gave Virgil a grin. She slid off her sunglasses.
"What should I have tonight, V?" she asked.
"Depends. Are we looking to flirt, celebrate, or get drunk?"
"All three."
"Sounds like a Bellini martini," he said.
"Done."
Virgil laughed, and Pam gave an exaggerated sigh as she settled herself at the table and fluffed her hair. Every motion Pam made was designed to draw attention to herself, and it worked. Around the bar, men stole glances at her. Anyone looking at the two of them could see that they were sisters, but Pam got the attention when they were together. It was partly her looks. Pam had spent some of her college money on breast implants, and she dressed to show them off. Her legs had the golden glow of time in the sun, but it was her attitude, too. Something about Pam screamed of sex.
"Where's Jason?"
Pam asked.
"He had to work late."
Pam shook her head.
"All work and no play. You should play with that boy more."
"Life's not all about play, Pam," Frankie said. Her sister rolled her eyes. Frankie couldn't blame her. Whenever she was with Pam, she lectured her like a child. It had been that way their whole lives. When Pam needed rescuing, Frankie was there. And Frankie, in turn, made her feel like shit. They may as well have been jealous teenagers. As they sat there, Frankie heard her phone ping. She had a new email at her personal address. When she checked her phone, she saw that it was the same sender as before. This time he wrote, "I remember you." Her sister read her frown from across the table.
"What's up?"
"Nothing." Frankie put down the phone and put the message out of her mind. Someone was playing games with her.
"Nothing at all."
Virgil brought Pam her martini, which had an amber glow and an orchid flower draped over the rim of the glass. Pam took a sip and licked her lips with her tongue.
"Perfect, Virgil. You are my savior."
"Sorry, Frankie and I covered religion. We're all going to hell."
"Dibs on that," Pam replied.
Virgil left them alone, and Pam eyed the crowd around them, taking a survey of the male faces. When someone smiled at her, she smiled back. Frankie wanted a report on Pam's day, but she knew she'd have to drag it out of her.
"How did the job interview go?"
Frankie asked. Pam didn't look back.
"Fine, great. I'm sure I got it."
"Did you even show up?" This time Pam stared at her, and her look was deadly.
"Excuse me? Did you go, or did you blow it off?"
"Of course I went."
"If I call, is that what they'll tell me?"
"Call them," Pam said. She took a sip of her drink and added, "It's so refreshing that you trust me." Frankie shrugged.
"You're right. I'm sorry."
The truth was that Pam had never given anyone in the family a reason to trust her, but Frankie didn't bother pointing that out. Living with a family of type A academics, Pam had deliberately gone in the opposite direction. She dropped out of college after a year. She bounced from job to job, dancer, waitress, model, and along the way she developed an addiction to cocaine and went through rehab twice. 5 years ago, she married a Portuguese web developer she'd met in a Mission District nightclub. He abused her. She cheated on him. When he kicked her out, she moved into Frankie's spare bedroom, and she was still there. Pam had money now. Their father had left them a small inheritance, but the way Pam was spending her share, Frankie didn't think that the nest egg would last more than a few years in her pockets. Pam couldn't think that far into the future, but Frankie did, and she'd been maneuvering to get Pam a job. Any job. The latest interview was with a PR firm that Frankie had worked with when she testified in a litigation case. Public relations was all about looking good, and Pam fit the bill. Frankie's phone pinged again. Another email. She hesitated, but she picked up her phone. The message was from the same person. It read, "What's your worst memory?" This time, Frankie angrily tapped out a return email with her slim fingers. "Who is this?" She sent it before she could think twice, and then slapped her phone down on the table. Pam noticed. "What's up?" "Just a troll. Tell me about the interview." "What's to tell?" Pam asked. "What kind of questions did they ask?" "I don't know. PR questions. Are you comfortable lying to a reporter's face? Would you sleep with a client to keep their business? That kind of thing." "Funny," Frankie said. "Come on, I'd be eye candy for them, but that's all. You know it, I know it. They know it." Frankie didn't say anything. She sipped her wine and studied her sister's face. Pam was hiding something, but that didn't narrow it down. She always kept secrets. She always lied. The only thing she was ever honest about was her bitter resentment of her older sister's success. "You didn't go, did you?" Frankie said. Pam sipped her martini. "No." "For God's sake, Pam." "What? I'm not broke anymore. I'll find a job when I am." "That won't take long if you keep coming home with Nordstrom bags. Do you know the strings I pulled to get you that interview?" "Yes. Thank you for taking pity on me," Pam snapped. "I'm done with you. That's it." "I'd like to think so, but you're never done, Frankie. Just like Dad was never done. I mean, you're on your own," Frankie told her. "What, do you want me to move out of your apartment? Get my own place? Is that what you want?" Pam's face was ice. "No." "Yes, a penthouse condo rent-free is pretty nice." "You want me to pay rent, Frankie? I'll pay rent." "That's not what this is about," Frankie shot back. It happened this way over and over. They couldn't be alone without arguing. Jason was the peacekeeper between them. Without him around, the two sisters took out their knives and aimed for each other's throats. Frankie hated it, and she knew she was just as much to blame as Pam. She'd hoped it would be different with their father gone, but they'd fallen right back into their dysfunctional routine after the accident. Frankie let the silence drag out. Then she asked more softly, "Pam, are you clean?"
"Excuse me?"
"Cocaine," Frankie said.
"Well, you were done interfering for a full 5 seconds. That's a new record even for you."
"I just want to know. When you've had money before, most of it went up your nose. That's the truth, Pam, whether you like it or not." Her sister looked around to see if anyone was listening. She leaned across the table.
"I go to meetings. You send Jason as my watchdog, remember? Don't worry, Frankie. I get my dose of humiliation every week."
"The meetings aren't intended to humiliate you. They're to keep you alive."
"Yeah, well, you don't have to go to them, do you? Be a good girl and stand up in front of the losers and tell them that I'm an even bigger loser. I'm sorry we can't all be world-class physicists and psychiatrists and neuroscientists. Some of us are just human beings."
Pam waved her hand, which collided with her martini glass and spilled her drink across the table. Pam swore and stood up to flag Virgil to get another. Frankie sopped up the puddle from the table with a wad of napkins. She was always cleaning up Pam's messes. Ping. Another email. She grabbed her phone to read the message. It was the same sender.
"I see you."
Frankie's head snapped up. Zingari was packed with customers shoulder to shoulder. Light was low, and she struggled to see the faces. Her eyes shot from person to person, looking for someone in the crowd who was looking back at her. Someone she knew. There was no one. She realized that her hand was trembling, and she could barely hold her phone. Across the table, Pam sat down again, her face tight with anger. She wouldn't look at Frankie.
"I'm sorry," Frankie murmured. Pam said nothing.
"Really, I mean it, Pam. I don't want to fight. I don't want to ruin your life. I know sometimes I act like I do."
"You're just like Dad," Pam retorted, knowing it was a low blow.
Frankie held her tongue, despite the temptation to start the argument all over again.
"Okay, you're right. Dad was always on your case, and I don't want to be like that. He drove me crazy, too, just not in the same way. He was difficult. "Difficult?" Pam said, as if the word didn't begin to describe him. Which was true. "The thing is, Dad and I made some progress when we were at Point Reyes, before the accident."
"How nice for you. But you didn't want me there, remember? You said all I'd do is get in the way."
Frankie hesitated. "Of course, I just mean... I'm sorry."
"Don't be. It is what it is."
Virgil leaned between them. His smirk, as always, was plastered on his face. He knew they were arguing. It wasn't the first time. He'd seen worse in the year they'd been coming here. The server carried a glass of Pinot Noir in his hand, and Pam frowned when she saw it.
"I wanted another martini, V."
"Don't worry, Bellini number two is on the way," he told Pam. "This drink is for Frankie, courtesy of a gentleman at the bar." Frankie looked up. "I see you."
"Who?"
she asked. Customers lined up three deep at the bar, and she couldn't pick out any familiar faces. Slick back, brown hair, beard, very tasty. Frankie studied the faces again, and this time she spotted a man staring back at her. Virgil was right. He was attractive. He was younger than she was, but he had a weak-in-the-knees smile that was like a secret weapon. His bearded chin was squared, and his nose made a sharp V with a pronounced ridge above his lip. He was smart, too. She could always see intelligence in the eyes. "Take the drink back," she told Virgil. But then she grabbed the server's wrist. "Wait, no, I'll do it myself." Frankie stood up. In her heels, she was taller than the man at the bar. She let her coldness soak into her face. She approached him, and he watched her with an amused confidence, as if women always wanted him to buy them a drink. He didn't look scary, but stalkers knew how to wear a mask. He was whistling, but he stopped as she came closer. She stood in front of him and drilled into his face with her stare. "Who are you, and why are you sending me emails? How did you get my personal address?" His blue eyes blinked with surprise. They were attractive eyes, and they latched onto her and didn't let go. "I'm sorry, I think you have me confused with someone else. My name is Frost Easton, Dr. Stein. I'm with the San Francisco police. I'd like to talk to you." 9. Frost sized up Francesca Stein. He'd met plenty of psychiatrists in his investigations, and they hadn't impressed him. They were happy to pretend they had all the answers, but if one of their patients shot up a movie theater, the finger of blame pointed everywhere except at themselves. He thought of them as gray little Freuds, probing for weaknesses like a child poking the stomach of a fat uncle. Stein didn't convey arrogance, but her brown eyes were cool. She had a classy grace about her that kept people at a distance. Her body was paper-thin, but she didn't look fragile. Her sister at the other table, they were obviously sisters, was the bombshell, but Frost found Frankie more interesting. She looked as if you could dig down a long way and never hit bottom. The server with the wild white hair, Virgil, found an empty window table for them. Outside, the pedestrian traffic filled the sidewalk. It was Friday night, and despite a cool mist off the ocean, the Tenderloin regulars were out in force on Post Street in the wildest of fashions. Frost's Suburban was parked in a red zone in front of the restaurant. Shaq slept on the top of the steering wheel, and the drunk girls who passed the SUV stopped to coo at him through the window.
"So what did you want to talk about, Inspector?"
she asked. Her voice had a surprising softness. "Bryn Lansing," he said. "She was one of your patients."
"I'm sure you know I can't say anything about my patients," Stein replied. And then, with a flicker of concern, she said,
"Was?"
"Bryn's dead."
Stein's dismay flew onto her face. It looked sincere.
"I'm so sorry to hear that. What happened?"
"She tried to climb the Bay Bridge. She didn't make it."
"What?"
He explained the incident in detail, and he watched Stein's face for her reaction. He saw only confusion.
"That's a terrible thing," she said when he was done. "And baffling."
"Well, I was hoping you could unbaffle it for me," Frost said. "After all, you were her therapist."
"Even if I could, I wouldn't be able to tell you anything. The patient privilege isn't automatically canceled by death."
"I thought you might say that," Frost replied, sliding a folded piece of paper from inside his coat pocket. "That's why I had Bryn's parents sign a release form,
Upon her death, they took over her power of attorney. Stein read the form.
Fair enough. I want to help if I can. Unfortunately, in this case, I don't think there's anything useful I can share with you. I hadn't seen Bryn in several weeks. The treatment we conducted was for a fairly minor problem. She was almost embarrassed to ask me about it.
Her fear of cats, Frost said.
Yes, that's right.
And you helped her forget about it? Frost asked. Is that how your treatment works?
He'd done his homework on Francesca Stein over the course of the afternoon. He tried to keep the cynicism out of his voice, but he failed. What he'd read made him think that Lucy was right. As pretty as she was to look at, this woman was a little like Dr. Frankenstein.
In simple terms, it's something like that, Stein told him. The process is called memory reconsolidation.
And how exactly do you do that?
Stein took her phone from her purse. It was connected to a portable battery charger. She pushed a few buttons, then extended her arm and gave the phone to Frost. This is a video I show people at conferences. Take a look. It only lasts a few seconds. Frost pushed the play button on the phone screen. He expected a dry academic lecture in a classroom, but instead he saw a video of an urban street somewhere in San Francisco. There were cars parked on the opposite curb. The street was lined with retail shops. Pedestrians walked back and forth in groups on both sides. As he watched, puzzled, a dark car drove into the frame and went without stopping through the intersection, where it T-boned another car with a sharp bang. Steam erupted. Voices shouted, and then the video cut off.
I don't understand, Frost said.
Let's see you witness this actual incident, Stein said, taking back her phone. That 10 seconds would be your reality. You can't re-experience it. You can't watch it again. All you can do is remember it.
Okay.
In other words, reality happens once, but memory happens over and over, Stein told him. Every time I ask you to think about the blue car that zipped through the stop sign and had an accident, your brain goes back and retrieves the memory, like a file from a cabinet. However, memories, unlike reality, aren't fixed. With every recollection, we reshape what we saw. Our memories of an event are influenced by how we want a situation to be, how we perceive our role in it, what people tell us, and even by what we hear or read about what took place. After a while, our brains can't distinguish between reality and our reconstruction of reality.
Eyewitnesses are unreliable, Frost said. I get it.
Exactly. Not only are they unreliable, they can be stubborn about it, too. Witnesses are often 100% convinced of the facts, even when they're wrong. And trauma can actually make it worse. You wouldn't think a rape victim would ever misidentify her assailant, right? And yet it happens. Innocent men have gone to prison because of it.
Like I said, people get it wrong. How does that relate to what you do?
Stein responded with a slight dip of her chin. She had a calmness and precision in everything she did. My point is that people can change their own memories without even being aware that they're doing so. The danger, and the opportunity, is that memories can also be deliberately altered. You may have heard about a controversy back in the 1980s, in which therapists helped patients recover repressed memories of abuse. Most of those recovered memories were discredited, but to the patient they became real. And it's not just therapists who are guilty of this kind of manipulation. Attorneys do the same thing, and so do police officers. Sometimes it's accidental and sometimes it's intentional.
How does that work? Frost asked.
Think about the video I showed you. The blue car races through the stop sign and gets into an accident. There were a variety of retail stores in the background. Which coffee shop was on the street? Do you remember? Think about it.
Frost did.
Finally, he said,
I think it was Starbucks.
Are you sure?
No, but I think so.
It wasn't Seattle's best.
I don't think it was. Why, am I wrong? Was it really Seattle's best?
Actually, there was no coffee shop on the street at all, Stein told him. But if we went over this a few more times, you would swear to me that it was a Starbucks. You'd see it in your head. Most coffee shops are Starbucks, so if someone plants the suggestion that there was a coffee shop, people tend to leap to the conclusion that they saw a Starbucks, even when it wasn't there at all.
Sneaky.
No, it's just how memory works. How fast do you think the blue car was going when it blew through the stop sign?
Want to hazard a guess?
Frost shrugged.
I'd say 35 miles an hour. It was going 20. The control group in my studies typically guesses 25. You went much higher. Do you know why?
I'm sure you're going to tell me, Frost said, slightly irritated.
I've described the blue car several times as zipping or racing through the intersection, blew through the stop sign. My characterization influences your brain. You sped up the car because of how I described the incident, not because of what you actually remembered.
Stein leaned forward and added,
In addition, you haven't corrected me about two important details, even though I've made the same mistakes several times.
Namely,
the car in the video was dark green, not blue, and there was no stop sign at the intersection. It was a yield sign.
Frost thought back to the video, and he realized to his dismay that he wasn't sure if she was telling the truth or not.
Stein smiled at him with a slight turn of her lips. I'm not trying to make you feel like a fool, Inspector. It's simply that this is how memory fails us. It's highly suggestible. If an attorney or police officer did what I did to an accident witness, they'd be very likely to remember a blue car going through a stop sign the next time they try to recall the incident. And that might be in a courtroom.
No offense, Dr. Stein, but you're not exactly making me feel good about your memory treatments. The whole process sounds dangerous. I read that some of your colleagues have tried to drum you out of the profession because of what you're doing.
You're right, Stein admitted. Altering memories is very risky. Because of the dangers involved, the traditional viewpoint in psychiatry is that you should never do it. You can try to sever the emotional response from the memory, but you shouldn't try to erase or replace the memory itself. Many therapists and scientists think our life is the product of our varied experiences, good and bad, and that we shouldn't mess with that.
But you're right and they're wrong? Frost challenged her.
Not necessarily. I just take a different view. I believe that a patient can decide for himself or herself how they want to be treated. It's their life, not mine, not anybody else's. The people who argue against assisted suicide aren't the ones who have to experience debilitating pain or watch a family member suffer. It's the same with painful memories. I'd rather empower a patient to live a better life. And if they want to do that by altering part of their past, that's their choice. After all, a tumor is part of your life experience too, isn't it? But we wouldn't hesitate to surgically remove it. So I don't think memories are sacrosanct.
Frost thought about his sister, Katie. All he had left of her was what he remembered. It made him believe that memories were sacred, the good and the bad, even though there were things that he wished he could forget. The car in the parking lot at Ocean Beach, the body in the back seat.
"And how exactly do you alter someone's memory?" he asked. "If you talk to my husband, Jason, he's a neuroscientist, he'll tell you that someday soon we'll be able to use a laser and an MRI machine to light up the synapses in your brain and zap a particular memory. I try to do the same thing therapeutically. It's a process I've spent more than 15 years honing and perfecting. It combines hypnosis with audiovisual stimuli."
"And drugs?" Frost asked.
"For some patients, yes, I'll use drugs to increase susceptibility to hypnotic suggestion."
"Does it always work?"
"No, of course not. There are no guarantees in psychiatry. My patients sign a release before treatment because working on the brain is not like working on a car. Sometimes it doesn't work. Some people can't let go of memories. In very rare circumstances, treatment can even make it worse, intensifying the emotion or the memory, rather than removing it."
"Enough that someone might, say, jump off a bridge?" Frost asked.
"If you're talking about Bryn Lansing, my answer is no. Her treatment was weeks ago. It went fine."
"So she couldn't suddenly wake up and imagine herself being attacked by hundreds of feral cats?"
"That's not how it works, Inspector. I don't know what caused Bryn to behave as she did, but it was nothing that happened in my treatment room. This was something else entirely. There's no connection."
"Are you sure?"
"I am," she insisted.
"Really? Then how do you explain Monica Farr?"
He saw anxiety bloom in Stein's eyes.
"What?"
"Monica Farr was another of your patients, wasn't she? I checked the contacts on her phone. She had an entry for Frankie. Guess whose number it was? And don't worry, I can get a signed release for her patient records, too."
"Are you saying that Monica is dead?" Frost told her. She had a psychotic breakdown, just like Bryn. She shot herself in the head. The color vanished from Stein's face. Her lips parted in horror. Oh, my God. Frost leaned forward across the table, and his voice was harsh. Let's face it, Dr. Stein, that's a hell of a coincidence. Two patients come to you for treatment, and both of them wind up going crazy and killing themselves? I think you better start asking yourself what you really did inside their heads. 10. What do you remember about Monica Farr? Jason asked. Frankie stood in front of the solarium windows in her penthouse condominium on O'Farrell. It was almost midnight. She watched the city, and she could feel the city watching her. The Art Deco building between Leavenworth and Hyde was tall, with an east view toward the bay. When the Giants played at home, she could see fireworks over the stadium. In the distance, the lights of the Bay Bridge stretched toward Oakland, and she shivered as she thought about Bryn Lansing. Heights had never bothered Frankie, but she wondered what it was like to die that way, at the mercy of gravity, like Bryn did, like her father did. Jason came up next to her and handed her a new glass of red wine. She'd already drunk too much this evening, and she felt the world floating, but she wanted more. Monica was an emergency room nurse from Utah, Frankie told him. Three children arrived at the hospital after a house fire in Salt Lake. All of the kids were badly burned, and all of them died. Monica couldn't get the episode out of her head. She moved to San Fran to get away from it, but she kept having flashbacks. She couldn't do her job anymore. How did you deal with it? Frankie pictured Monica in her head. Young, red-headed, slightly overweight. Monica's face lit up when she talked about patients she'd helped. They had that in common. Frankie remembered the treatment strategy she'd chosen for her. The strategy was the most delicate part of therapy. That was where she had to read her patients and create a new reality that their minds would embrace. I didn't want her to forget that the kids had died, she said. She dealt with loss every day. It was too much a part of who she was as a nurse. Instead, I helped her believe that she wasn't really in the room when it happened. She didn't see them die with their own eyes. I was hoping that would be enough to let her work through it. Monica wasn't fragile. Nurses are tough. This was simply one tragedy too many. Did the treatment work? Jason asked. I thought it did. Monica called me a few weeks later. She was working as a nurse again. Graveyard shift ER. It doesn't get harder than that. But she sounded happy. She was calling to thank me. So you did your job, Frankie. Don't second guess yourself. Yes, but now she's dead, and so is Bryn Lansing. That's two of my patients showing signs of severe brain dysfunction. Jason shook his head. Whatever happened to them wasn't your fault. How do you know? Frankie asked. He had no answer for her. He was just trying to make her feel better. He put an arm around her waist as they stood by the windows. She liked the closeness of him. She could see his reflection in the glass, his short, gelled dark hair, his sharply angled chin, his arching eyebrows and intense stare. He wore gray dress slacks and a slim-fit forest green shirt. Her fingertips drifted onto his thigh, making soft circles. Then she pulled away, and she could feel his disappointment. "Is it possible?" she asked. "What? Could I have harmed these women with my memory treatment?" Jason scowled. It was late, and he didn't want a clinical discussion. She knew what he really wanted. Sex. "I can't say it's impossible," he admitted. "There aren't any absolutes in brain chemistry, you know that. People behave in unexpected ways. All I can tell you is that it's very unlikely that your treatment could have produced such an extreme reaction, particularly so long after the therapy ended. I'm not saying the possibility is zero, but the risk is low." "Risk," Frankie murmured. She was thinking about her father again. It was funny how everything eventually led her back to him and their last weekend together. She couldn't escape it. The theme of the discussion he'd chosen for their annual camping trip was risk. What chances are you willing to take to get what you want? What dangers do your choices create for other people? She could hear her father's voice in her head. It had no intonations, no ups, no downs. He lectured and posed questions the way a professor would, rather than a father with a child. He jabbed with his finger to make his points. His grizzled face didn't move.